Sounds like we got a real problem out here. Any of you incel, QAnon, 4chan, Snyder Cut motherfuckers want to get on a line now?
This is the Extra Hawk Ray Podcast, episode 413 for the week of June 27th, 2022. I am ball breaker David T. Cole, and I'm here with Italian Ice Prize winner Sarah D. Bunting.
These fucking dorks.
Mrs. Always Right, Tara Ariano.
Just read the apron.
And fancy beef sandwich, Nadia Chaudhry.
So casual, so delicious.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she's a writer and editor at Eater Austin. You've heard her here with us before. It's Nadia Chaudhry. Hello, Nadia.
Ooh, welcome, Nadia. Hi.
Welcome back. Last time Nadia was here, it was to share her expertise about being a New York kid while we were talking about the Gossip Girl reboot. Now it's we're using her food expertise because we are talking about The Bear. Carmi. Jeremy Allen White was at the top of his career working as a chef in some of America's most acclaimed restaurants. Then his brother Michael died and left him the family business, a beef sandwich restaurant in the River North neighborhood of Chicago. The bills pile up and Carmi's attempts to apply Michelin star discipline to the kitchen at the original beef of Chicagoland go poorly until a fellow trained chef named Sydney, Ioa Debary, applies to be sous chef, bringing with her culinary ambitions of her own. All 8 episodes of the first season dropped on Hulu last Thursday. We'll probably mostly focus on the first one since we don't assume that you all spent Sunday watching the whole run like Dave and I did. Let's do the Chen check-in. Nadia, should our listeners watch The Bear?
Yes.
Sarah?
For sure.
Dave?
Agreed.
Me too. Aw.
All Yay! Consensus. So and now, around the dial.
Yeah. Well, let's get into The Bear just a teeny bit more. Nadia, episode 4, name checks Eater. Does this obligate you to like the show or would it have grabbed you even without pandering to you directly?
Both can be true. It's partially why I'm still a fan of the morning show for that one Eater reference
right.
that I have screenshot on my computer. I'm curious how it reads to people who aren't consumed by All Thoughts restaurants right. as I am. Or people who haven't worked in restaurants like that. But I was really interested in the premise that they set up because it's a story that I am going to guess is familiar to a lot of restaurant owners right now, especially mm-hmm. during these ongoing COVID times where and like supply shortages and right. trying to make something so appealing and trying to everyone while also trying to do something different.
Yeah. Well, I've never worked in a restaurant, and I certainly have not owned a restaurant. I was fascinated by it. And Sarah, I recently made you watch and talk about the Kitchen Confidential sitcom on a Patreon episode of our sister podcast, again with this. Mm-hmm. And at the time, we talked about what could have made that show work as a backstage at the restaurant show. Did you feel that The Bear was the show that we wanted Kitchen Confidential to be?
Yeah, I think so. And I think one of our issues was that... so much of what makes The Bear amazing, like, had to be sanitized out for the network version of it in Kitchen Confidential.
Yes.
And the fact that there's so much swearing, so many, like, gnarly tangles of cords, and, like, there's one cut in episode 2 where you just see, like, the aftermath of a dinner service, I guess, and it looks like... it reminded me of that smash cut in Born on the 4th of July when you cut to like Tom Cruise's room in this Grotsky VA hospital. Mm-hmm. And there's just like stuff everywhere. And I was like, ugh. And I was also like, I'm not sure that's the association they want me to have, but it was extremely evocative. And this show is like actually stressful to watch. Like
yeah.
my background in food service was as a pizza liaison.
Mm-hmm.
I was a delivery girl, so there was less of this, but there was not none of
yeah.
this. And it just like it was so appealingly processy,
yeah.
And like gritty in a good way, but also just like I could feel my heart rate going up when things were happening and he can't find the knife and all this stuff. I mean, it's like, it's really, I hate the word immersive almost as much as I hate the word propulsive, but it is both of those things. God help me. Every now and then you have to use these words.
Yeah.
I really liked it.
I did too.
And I'm also sure that like it's semi or maybe fully traumatic to people who have worked in the restaurant industry in these high energy, high stressful, demanding chefs not doing the right thing. If you're not doing the right thing, you're doing wrong. And
yeah,
I mean, the sort of toxic-y to a degree backs of house environments that we should probably try to get away from, mm-hmm. but it's also still there and still very true.
Yeah. Dave, they appealed directly to you with a little pandering in a later episode where you see some donuts being made.
Oh, yeah, right. Yes, my experience in the food industry is two things. One, I worked at a very high-end royalty-based burger shop called Burger King for 3 days. Before I moved into, I did. And I can tell you exactly what it was. I know I've told the story before, but it was during the first week of burger bundles. If mm-hmm. that sends anybody back, it was their version of sliders, except there were actually one thing you had to pull them apart yourself. Anyways, the guidance counselor at my school gave me a ring and said the donut shop across the street from the high school, they were looking for a baker. Would you be interested? And they told me it was $50 a night. And I was like, cha-ching, $50.
In the 80s.
And so what it entailed is going there pretty late at night to start with and baking the whole thing for the day before. This wasn't like, it was like one independent bake shop. It wasn't like a regional thing where they make them all in some factory and they get there. So I had to make everything. And it showed exactly. It's been a little while since I've seen donuts on screen that actually went through everything and it looked exactly as I remember it. The only thing they left out was a guy going, ah, ooh, ah, every time he put the donuts, like plop the donuts in the fryer. And it was just like 50-50. Every donut, you're going to get splashed a little grease. Mm-hmm. But the whole thing, flipping them after a minute, putting them on, you know, pulling them out, glazing them or rubbing them in the sugar and all that kind of stuff. I kind of loved that job because I made so much more money than anybody else. Granted, I had to work from like 11 at night to like 2 or 3 in the morning sometimes, but my parents didn't care. So that was great. And I just like, was
how old were you?
High school.
15, 16, 17, I think, by the time I left. Yeah. Because I think they went out of business because it was very poorly run.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed that part of it. What I would say to people watching The Bear from the get-go, having not consumed any of it yet, the first episode really, for me, needed to settle down. It was like, I got a bag of tricks. Here we go. The editing is really frenetic. And yeah. I was like, Bear, you gotta simmer down. And it did after, like, it doesn't go from, like, 100 to 0, but, like, even things that didn't need to be crazy, just like, here's a couple of shots of Chicago. Wham, zoom, bam, boom, bam, bam. It's like Homer Simpson all-star wipes all the time. And it's the creator did like everything in the first episode and it kind of shows. Mm-hmm. And then as the names and the credits become more diverse, I feel like it found its rhythm a lot better. Mm-hmm. And that includes, I think, a focus away from the lead character and more of a look at his number two and then everybody else in the staff. Because I feel like maybe the show isn't actually about him, it's about her.
Yeah.
That's the better show anyways. Those are the parts where I was most engaged. When Sydney sort of comes in and she also has like a background in fancy restaurateuring, and we find out eventually she has sort of a negative experience trying to go out on her own.
Yeah.
And all the baggage that brings into it. I feel like that dynamic worked really well, but I was so much more invested in her story mm-hmm. than it was in his.
Yeah, and I agree with that, but I think they find a good balance between the two of them, because that's partly what it's about, too. It's about, like, finding the middle ground between their approaches.
Yeah, but I'm glad it settled down to my liking after the first episode, because it was just like, ow, my eyes, stop.
Yeah. Here's a specific restaurant question for Nadia, because this is something that bugged me straight from the jump. It's a sandwich restaurant. Should it open at 3 or should it open at 11? Because I feel like 11 to 7 is better hours for this joint than 3 to 10. What? Tell us with your expertise. Do you agree?
I mean, yes, like sandwich restaurants should be open for lunch, but I mean, I don't know how they do things in Chicago. Sure. It's not for me to say.
That's maybe why it's the dinner sandwiches. Because yeah. out here, you open that shit at 6:30 in the morning to get the like fishermen and we're, you know, working through lunch
right.
on a road construction site trade.
Yeah. Yeah.
My excuse for them probably is that he came into the restaurant new. So they're still testing out what the hell they're going to do. I mean, Grant, they didn't even have enough meat for dinner service.
Right.
So I'm going to assume that had a play in it as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird question marks around that. Like, I didn't really get a bead on what the feel of the neighborhood was that they were in, because it seemed like it used to be kind of a rundown worker class neighborhood, perhaps with industrial stuff sort of like, you know, in the day around it. But now it was becoming condos and stuff like that. But it really hadn't hit yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like in Austin when you went to Mueller about 2 years ago to the Alamo and you're like, what the hell is this? It's sort of like that, where it's just like, There's a theater and there's like one Irish pub and then like two apartments. Like, what is this? And then like, how do you serve that neighborhood? Right.
Yeah.
So I understand that the restaurant was struggling, but I also don't understand how they were ever really making it in a neighborhood like that, because it seemed like at odds with what they were offering.
Yeah. Well, they do establish that what's being built across the street is a Sweetgreens, which says a lot. But they also, there's another episode later on where like, there has to be outreach to the local standing on the corner gentleman to like figure out where's the right place for them to be standing to do whatever their business is. And it's none of anyone's business but theirs, sort of thing. So yeah, neighborhood in transition for sure is, I think, accurate. This is to the vegetarians. Did this show miss an opportunity by focusing so much on the beef part of the original Beef of Chicagoland's name, Sarah?
No. I mean, look, I watch Top Chef and all these cooking shows, and like, I've just accustomed myself to looking at glistening cuts and being like, you know, I remember that fondly, and you just have to sort of move on and hope that someone makes a nice tomato bisque every now and then, which, you know, no, that wasn't bothersome to me. I mean, and sometimes it looked really gross. Like, you know, college dorm food. So
some of the shots of the beef on the sandwiches were pretty gray. I was kind of surprised how like just colorless the whole thing looked. But my vegetarian is sort of like my attitude on religion. Like, I don't care what you do. I just don't want to hear about it.
Yeah.
Hearing and seeing meat being cooked, like, I don't give a shit. Yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. No, me neither.
But I feel like for this restaurant in Chicago, what else would they be doing?
Right.
Right. I mean, it serves the story.
Yeah.
A note that I took for myself was sloppy, yummy cooking. So I feel like that's the best description of it.
Yeah. There was also a lot of talk in the first episode about making spaghetti for the family meal, which like at the end of the episode, we're like, let's have pasta for dinner.
Yeah, we did.
And we did. We were almost the whole way through the season before I realized one of the elements that made this show so refreshing was that there's no voiceover narration used as a crutch. But at the same time, it reveals all the characters so organically. I feel like this is one of the least pilot-y pilots I've seen in a while, maybe ever. Nadia, what did you think about the way the production sort of situates the viewer in this story, in the setting?
I mean, I loved how they just throw us into it, and by like exposition that's not like grating or too hand-holy, we just learn about the way the kitchen works, and it's a sort of a slow burn in terms of like who this guy is, how he inherited the restaurant. I feel like there was a reference to being in a post-COVID world, but that could have just been my interpretation
of
that.
No,
they do. Oh, great. And just like the dynamic of like this outsider guy, even though he's part of the family, coming into this kitchen that already has its established rules and relationships, but they're open to him eventually too. Like when the guy calls him chef. I like that better. And it makes me like want to watch that second episode already because it's not just like a lot of plot going forward.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like being in the kitchen in itself, too. You're just thrown into it. So that's how it is.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like the chaos of the setting is foundational to the show working. So,
oh, God, there is an episode, and I'll just explain around what actually happens. But there's an episode later in the season where they try something new and it is too successful. And it just is so tense, the whole thing. And it just keeps on building and building and building. It does really well what they sort of screwed up for me a little bit in the first episode, which is like that kinetic feel was so much more organic later in the mm-hmm. season than what they were trying to manufacture with the editing in the first one. But yeah. that episode was just like, made me so uncomfortable in such a entertaining way.
Oh, it's hugely effective. That's episode 7. And it either is one continuous take or they cheat it to make it look like it is. Yeah. And it's the shortest episode of the season. But at the end of it, you're like,
yeah.
It's like a one long panic attack.
I think that would be the episode I opened up for the canon for this show.
Yes, yeah, agree.
So season 7, when you get there.
Yes. Yeah. This is a show that's like really mostly, I would say, a lot of vibe, but not a lot of plot. And I think that feels right.
Well, so much of the show is like, it's a show about people who always talk, never stop talking, but never communicate, right? Like that's sort of like the foundational relationship of everybody else to everybody.
Yes.
For a lot of the first season of this show.
Yeah.
And the restaurant stuff is happening through all of that. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's this business that is sort of set up for better or for worse, like it's an army brigade. You know, they actually institute mm-hmm. the brigades, the French brigade system or whatever eventually.
Yeah.
And like, you get that sense that it is like the army, where it's like you do what you're told, don't talk, don't get involved, like, you know, but they're bad at everything to do with communicating.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, let's talk about the casting a little bit. Sarah and I were talking on the weekend about Jeremy Allen White as Carmi. Sarah, you made an excellent comparison to who he reminded you of. Please share.
Strong Fichtner vibes. Like, yeah.
Pocket size Fichtner for sure.
There's no replacing famous original Fichty, but mm-hmm. if that day should come.
He's got a little DNA of James Dale, Eagle Dale.
James Badge Dale, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, from, a little bit.
From Rubicon, yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would love to know what, and I'm sure this information is available, but I'm going to look it up, like how it was shot in terms of like, were they all sort of thrown together and made to sort of run these scenes over and over again, because that feeling of them as a unit mm-hmm. is very, like, it's very deep and genuine. And the little throwaway lines and the way that they'll be self-deprecating or giving each other shit just feels completely organic and not all that scripted. Like a lot of the teasing that it's Richie, right? The number 2.
Yeah, Richie.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the teasing that Richie gives out and also takes. First of all, I love a TV character that swears as much as I do. Fucking A. But there's like a sequence where they're giving him shit about going to DeVry. And then he's like rushing out to fix something. It's like, DeVry teach you to fix that? He's like, fuck off. And then they're like, did you graduate? And on his way out the door, he's like, fuck no. And is laughing like, this is my favorite role of his by mm-hmm. far. I don't usually like him, but it's not, I now realize it's not him. It's like other stuff he's in. Like in Girls, I was like, I hate you, but that's a girl's problem.
Yeah, that's Eben Moss Bachrach playing Richie. Last seen as John Carreyrou in The Dropout, of all mm-hmm. things. So this is real departure. Yeah, I agree that the scenes have a play-like kind of feel in the way people interact. And usually I mean that as an insult. Here I mean it as a compliment. Nadia, who were your standouts in the cast?
I really liked Sydney. I liked how quiet, but like that she tried to like connect with these people. But and even when she kept like getting like blocked out, she still didn't stop. And like people were still like when she was asking where the family meal ingredients where the woman was like, but then the other guy was like, here it is. Mm-hmm. And how she went all for it with this like interestingly plated in deli cups, plantains and the fennel. And I forget what the rice, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm like very intrigued by her. And like her resume was like ridiculous to me. She worked at Alinea. That's like hella fancy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really, really curious to see how she like interacted with Cam too, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm very, very interested to see where she's going from.
Dave, the ball breaker arcade game in the dining room.
Yeah.
It's a big plot point in the first episode.
Right.
Did you have any fact checking that you wanted to do on that?
I don't have any fact checking. I was impressed with the level of detail that went into this fake video game in this world. So like the backstory is there's this video game is called Ball Breaker, and it's basically like a Street Fighter clone, except everything has to do with testicles.
Mm-hmm.
And they even have in Street Fighter, well, Street Fighter 2 is sort of like the first one everybody remembers. Street Fighter 1's a garbage game, don't play it. Street Fighter 2 in the arcade, if you remember, when you would choose your character, there'd be like a big map of the world. So their map is just the USA, except like where usually California is, there's like an ass there, or rather there's a scrotum there.
Mm-hmm.
And all the characters, you know, have like the stuff through the testicles. It was a lot of work put into it, and I do appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
So like they actually did hire somebody to make a rudimentary game of some sort that they could, you know, enact in order to film the stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like the backstory is that it's sort of like a rarity, like it was released but then like recalled right away. So they have like a few of these things and they hold tournaments and like everybody from
Scandinavia is involved.
Yeah.
Like the way that whole backstory was delivered was like this was a lot of thought mm-hmm. that went into this thing that's like a running gag that like you're only seeing the tip of the iceberg of mm-hmm. Sort of prep that went into creating this part of the joke that mm-hmm. we see.
Yeah.
And that was when I sort of was like, okay, show.
Yeah.
I get it. And like everyone's cosplaying out front, I was like, this is absolutely like this particular kind of corner of the internet has been seen and digested by mm-hmm. the creators of this show in a way that felt really familiar and fond.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a good show. I mean, it is stressful sometimes to watch, but it's good.
We already talked about episode 7 in terms of things to look forward to. We also do meet Michael, Carmi's brother, in a flashback later on, and he is also perfectly cast. That's all I'll say. But yeah, this show is really special. It feels extremely assured. And, you know, if it's something that was not on your radar, put it on your radar because it's really rewards a watch. And the episodes are like true half hours or less. There's only 8 of them, so we really did watch it all in an afternoon and evening. Sarah?
I just have one more question before we wrap it up, and that's for Dave.
Yep.
Would you say that Chicago was a character?
You know what? I actually didn't really feel it in this one.
Mm.
Like, I felt the people were from Chicago, but it didn't need to be in Chicago necessarily. Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like that. The amount that you get in the neighborhood and everything like that, it could have been Vancouver.
Oh, I don't agree with that.
Ouch. I did appreciate the Malort billboard that they squeezed in, and I just laughed out loud when I saw that. And Malort is disgusting, by the way. But
I mean, that Malort billboard is almost a character, I'll say that. It comes back in future episodes, too.
It is time to go around the dial talking about something we've been watching on TV lately. Our first stop is Tara.
I watched Loot. This is a new sitcom on Apple TV Plus. We should specify. It's LOOT, not LUTE, in case you didn't know. It's not about
different show.
Chamber music. Maya Rudolph plays Molly Novak, who is married to John Adam Scott, an unimaginably rich tech guy. And as we meet her, it's her birthday. At her party, she tells him what she'd like the most is not the obscenely gigantic yacht he's just bought her. Like, I'm talking 3 times the size of any yacht we've ever seen the Roys of Succession on. But she just wants the two of them to have dinner together alone. He's really busy, but maybe when he comes back from Sweden. And then she goes into their closet and finds his young employee, Haley, played by Dylan Galula, Xanthippe from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. She's also in there getting John a tie because, whoops, John and Haley are fucking. So Molly and John get divorced. Molly ends up with $87 billion because they've been together since before he was rich and they never had a prenup. And she spends the next several months partying around the world with her assistant. And after her fall into a pool at a party is widely reported, she gets a call from Sophia, played by Michaela J. Rodriguez from Pose, who runs the namesake charity that Molly apparently only kind of knew she had. Sophia just wants Molly to keep a low profile so her public bullshit does not reflect poorly on the foundation. But suddenly, Molly wants her life to have meaning and start being very hands-on with the foundation. This show has many of the same problems as The Morning Show. Starting with, it was made by people who have been rich for a really long time, so their efforts to make us invest in this character who is wildly out of touch are complicated by the fact that they are maybe wildly out of touch. Mm-hmm. Their creators are Alan Yang and Matt Hubbard, who have worked on Parks and Recreation, 30 Rock, and The Good Place, among others. So a considerable percentage of the first 3 episodes, which is all that has dropped so far and all I will be watching, are spent showcasing Molly's unimaginable wealth, Yacht, house, private jet with a hot tub, room in her house that's all just candy and giant glass jars, personal chef David Chang, who she asks in the first episode to make her a microwave burrito. Since the point of the show is ostensibly to take us on Molly's journey as she tries to do something important with her life other than enjoy being rich, it's so much screen time to spend on lifestyles of the rich and famous glamour segments that we are supposed to think are totally empty, but which the show seems more ambivalent about. And the other morning show problem is Apple TV Plus has a lot of very good shows, which I enjoy a lot. But it also seems like Apple TV Plus gives its creators a lot of notes about avoiding politics that are going to make people mad. The problem in this case is you can't make a show about a billionaire, even one who became a billionaire via divorce settlement, without being political. Like, Molly's Foundation supposedly focuses on community issues in Southern California, but in the first three episodes, other than one terrible photo op at a shelter, the foundation seems to exist as the way Molly is going to find herself, and the people who have needs that the foundation is supposed to be addressing don't exist on the show. After I tweeted about it, past and future guest Allison Herman of The Ringer DM'd me. So we went back and forth with me being like, did this pay off? Did this pay off? And the answer was always no. So we'll link to her excellent review in the show notes because it says everything I needed to know. But the closest thing we have to Molly interacting with anyone who's struggling in life is with the staff at her house, which is like 60 people, all of whom apparently think she's great. Like, there's a joke in quotes about in the premiere about her making a cleaner spoon her in bed. And then we cut to this cleaner and she's Latina and she just smiles beatifically, like spooning this woman who's her boss in bed is all she wants in life. Like, I mostly want to tell every TV writer whose brain was broken by The Good Place, every sitcom doesn't have to be about someone who's trying to be a better person. Shitheads are also good comedy. Ask the nation of England. Like, if you want to make a show about how sick it would be to have $87 billion and fuck around all the time, that's fine. I would watch that show. Like, that's there's nothing wrong with that as an idea for a show. But don't watch Loot. If you want to watch a version of this idea that actually has something to say, Made for Love on HBO Max. And if you want to watch the one show on Apple TV Plus that is not scared of politics, watch three excellent seasons of Dickinson. Dave also suffered through the first episode of this. Dave, did you have anything to add?
I don't remember that much of it. It was kind of also boring, you know, on top of all the, you know, like, let's make a non-political show non-political, like the double Apple TV-ness of it all.
Yeah.
But I was just saying, there's a lot of people very angry that the name for a show, Loot, is now taken, because that should be a show about video games for sure.
For my plug, I am going to direct our listeners to the National Network of Abortion Funds. We will link them in the show notes. They are doing the work that needs to be done right now. So please, if you have any money to send their way, do that. NNAF.org.
All right, Nadia, what do you have for us?
I am obsessed with Ms. Marvel. I know y'all talked about this already, but I love Ms. Marvel for the way it depicts a regular Muslim family and community and person, and the way they refer to, like, holidays and religious ceremonies and just religious rituals, and that praying at the mosque and the cleaning up or cleaning, like cleansing yourself before going into the mosque, and just little things. The way it's just beautiful and wonderful, and it makes me smile. I enjoyed how they called the Eid that isn't related to Ramadan the lesser Eid, which is true, but and just the way, because I know they're an Urdu family. My family is Bangladeshi, so we speak Bengali. But there's certain Urdu phrases that, like, I recognize, or certain Islamic phrases that I recognize. And it's just nice hearing those things out loud in a show and being depicted in a show. And another thing that I really enjoyed about the show, that I am enjoying about the show, is the way they're actually talking about the big partition, which is something I feel that isn't really depicted on television shows, especially grand general population appealing television shows like Ms. Marvel is. The partition is when in the Indian subcontinent, which now includes Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, was one whole big country, India, under British Empire. When they won their independence from the British Empire, they were divided into India, which was mostly Hindi, and then East and West Pakistan were more Muslim dominated countries. So they were split up into that, and families were ripped apart. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of not great stuff like that. But to have it be a center point, a plot point of like a superhero TV show is really neat. And yeah, I could go on about that. It just makes me very happy.
It's not uncommon in comic book stories to have like, you know, a origin story that hinges on something tragic and traumatic. Like Magneto was, you know, a child in the concentration camp. Mm-hmm. This is now like other people's story, right? Like this, and we're seeing, when we're talking about the show, we're just talking about the first episode just because of our schedule versus the release. So there's been a couple more episodes out now, and I like how they're doing all that you're saying, but also like it is fun and light, but also informative and serious at the same time. And they're walking such a good fine line with all that. And it's just kind of an impressive feat because, yeah, like, it is so easy to screw up on any of those columns, and they're doing
it's
a good job keeping it
bright and poppy, but also like talking about real things in a way that's not like Debbie Downer or like here's a history lesson or something like that.
Right, because like you get a lot of information and storyline about what's happening in the mosque via her friend without going like deep on the sort of, you know, like the gender politics and everything that's going on in there. And you know, I feel like at this junction in America's cultural history, that is a lot for people to digest. When I say people, I just mean like white people.
Very true.
And so I feel like they're just doing a really good job of representing that culture in a way that is digestible, but entertaining, but not fluffy.
And not like shiny, or it's like, it's true. Yeah. And it's still true. And it's not like glossing over things at the very least that a lesser show would have probably.
Did you read the comics at all? Or
I read the first five issues. Yeah. I remember bits. It was like a couple years ago. So I remember bits and pieces of it. I know like the whole hoopla about like, I know people are upset about her, them changing her actual powers, but like, it's fine with me.
Yeah.
And for your plug?
I mean, I'm going to also echo Tara's note about donating to abortion funds. And I would also urge people to seek out mutual aid fund groups in your local states or states that have very conservative slash trigger laws, because they're the ones doing a lot of the groundwork and know how to navigate systems and all of that stuff. In general, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram, Nadia Chaudhary. I'm also the editor of Eater Austin, where I cover food and restaurant news in the city of Austin.
All right, Sarah DeBunny, what do you have?
Well, keeping it fluffy. not really. The Janes dropped on HBO Max earlier this month. It is a documentary that explores the underground network that sprang up in Chicago in the late 1960s to provide women access to abortion services before Roe v. Wade legalized the procedure. It is directed by Tia Lesson, who was nominated for an Oscar for Trouble the Water, and Emma Pildes. The Janes deploys an effective mix of archival footage of 60s Chicago and talking head interviews past and present, but it begins with a particularly bracing first-person story about a rundown motel, a painful procedure that costs 3 months' rent. This documentary is not going to be for everyone right now. There are also terms like perforated and carbolic acid and the septic abortion ward that, quote, was full every day. They show you the note cards that this network of Janes kept on clients with notes like 23 has four kids and be cautious, father is a cop and has $1. A look back at the view from second class may not seem as advantageous to the mental health this week as, say, a tray of Kraft dinner and vintage baking show episodes. I get it. But as grim and dispiriting as the Janes can sometimes feel, I still recommend it because it's also a heartening experience in certain ways. Like, these women saved and changed thousands of lives because it had to get done, and it did. It's tough going at times, but it moves right along. It's 101 minutes, but it doesn't feel like it. It is a pleasure to look at. That archival footage is really something. There is one talking head involving some instruments, but you'll know when it's coming and you can avert your eyes from that. And I actually felt honored to witness these stories from these women. Like, what What nads, truly. If you feel like you can't right now, I completely get it. But stash it on your wash list for another time, because I do recommend it, not just as a good sit, but also, I think, as a corrective for people who think a post-Roe Gilead isn't actually where we all live right now. Like, I do think that this will sort of get a message of urgency through to some people. For my plug, I reviewed this in full at my true crime newsletter that I write with Eve Beatty, bestevidence.fyi, and you can also find links there from last week to an abortion funds and action resource list that we put together so that people wouldn't feel quite so overwhelmed slash paralyzed. That's available to all on the site, and we encourage you to check it out and add to the thread any links that you think might be helpful.
All right, buckle up, mister. Here we go on the next Extra Extra Hot Greats, because we are about to enter into a period of vacation-y, family obligation-y times. Coming up on the next Extra Extra Hot Greatest, let's watch Dean Stockwell and Leonard Nimoy on The Twilight Zone. That is this coming Friday. And then after that, we've got the best purple things on television. It's exactly what you think it is. Yep. What are the best purple things on television, you may ask? We may have the answers for you. And then on the third Extra Extra Hot Great coming up, it is Important TV Balls.
Yeah, it is.
On EHG Prime next week, we're unlocking four Patreon topics about the holidays or vacations. And then next week after that on Extra Hot Great 415, it is listener forcenings from our Patreon piece. We asked them, what do you want us to watch? They gave us a whole bunch of suggestions. We each picked the one that spoke to us, and we watched it, and we talked about it, and it was in the kind of middle distant past now.
It was a long time
ago.
And I kind of remember I did Buck Rogers, and I think Jerry Orbach played a evil music producer that is trying to take over the universe.
That's right.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, great. Mm-hmm. Let's look forward to that. Yeah. And then we're back in the studio on 416 for Frogging Hider in My House with Jeff Drake. And that might be my contender for best titled TV thing of the year. Oh, I forgot to put a plug in for Hill Country Fair Pineapple Soda. If you want to taste 14 melted popsicles in one can, this is the drink for you. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. We have a user submission this week. Take it away, Helen.
Hi, Extra Hot Great. This is Helen from Melbourne, Australia, and I am presenting for the Canon. New Girl, Season 4, Episode 17, Spider Hunt. The start of New Girl was a little rocky, and the marketing of its adorkableness turned many people off. It's a pity, because those who didn't make it past the first few episodes missed that it became a wonderful, low-key hangout comedy. The pleasure of the show was in the very lived-in history of the characters' relationships. We feel that they know each other, and that, although we only see them in a few settings, the loft, the bar, occasionally workplace, we still feel like their lives continue when we are not there. Spider Hunt is a bit of a bottle episode, taking place entirely within the loft. But that's not an outlier for New Girl, which was at its best when just giving us the cast goofing around. My reasons for choosing this episode to submit are twofold. Firstly, it's just a great fun example of a gang mess around. And secondly, it features one of the best examples of that old sitcom trope, the conversation where two people think they're talking about the same thing, but they're not. We'll get to that one later. The spider hunt in this episode is a great example of how the show builds situations out of the characters and their unseen history. It shows us something we've never seen before, but which we totally believe. That Schmidt would be terrified of spiders, that he would have a gross reason behind this fear, and that the loft residents would have a system to deal with this, even though we've never seen any of this. There's very little background needed to set up this episode. CC has recently realised she still has feelings for Schmidt, but he's currently dating Fawn, a very ambitious LA councilwoman. CC has let this slip to Winston, but he's the only one in the loft who knows, and she desperately doesn't want Jess to find out. Please play clip one.
Jess is starting to find your behaviour suspicious. That's a police word.
It's not a police word, Winston. It's a very common word, and you know why I'm keeping my distance. I like Schmidt.
For the second time.
I know how many times.
You can see my face right now. I'm smiling and I'm saying,
And if Jess finds out, she's going to want to get involved. And I don't want her involved because there's nothing that she can do.
Look, if you act suspicious, then she's going to be suspicious, all right? Look, don't slink your head in the dumps. You got to raise your hand with the sunshine where people walk, you know? Because that's what the whole point of the... Because if you can lead them to water, but you can't make a sound, right? Look, just call her.
Fine, okay, I'll call her, but... And listen to me. She cannot find out.
Under no circumstance.
Okay, baby. Look, your secret is safe with me. That being said, I am not a smooth man.
Yeah, I get that.
And also, Nick is making sauce. Jess notices a spider on Schmidt and brushes it off, leading to General Schmidt panic and the need for the eponymous spider hunt. She convinces Cece to come over to help. Winston overhears and immediately gets caught by Jess when he tries to lie. Clip two.
So... going on with Cece?
Well, I had to beg her like a nerd, but she's finally coming over.
Oh, she's coming over.
Took a lot of cajoling.
That's cool.
It's like she'll come over all the time.
But now it's different. I don't know why that would be the case at all, but that's cool. I respect the decision for her to come over.
Why are you acting weird?
I'm acting weird?
Do you know something?
Do I? I'm not a smooth man.
Is she mad at someone?
No. She's not mad at anyone. It's the opposite.
It's the opposite?
That's not what I said.
You said, no, she's not mad at anyone. It's the opposite.
I said, whoa. Cheese is bad, everyone. Let's stop and spit.
Opposite of mad is... Does she like someone?
Ever the school teacher, Jess organizes the spider hunt, splitting everyone into two-man teams, Smooshers and Jarmen. This allows the cast to spend the episode split up into twosomes, swapping several times and displaying the various character dynamics. Schmidt, still terrified about the spiders, has a request for Coach in clip three.
Hey, you know, I bet I could spot the spider a lot better if I was on your shoulders.
Do not ask me again to get on my shoulders. That's a once-a-year thing, and you already used it on Halloween when we were 10-foot-tall Ralph Macchio.
Jess has paired herself with Cece so that she can interrogate her. Cece's trying to avoid the subject, instead making her case for installing a popcorn machine at the bar where she and Nick work. But Jess dozes in with the questions. Determined not to admit liking Schmidt, Cece manages to deflect, and this conversation leads to a couple of my favourite New Girl insults in clip four.
Right. You can't tell anybody except freaking Winston, that slow puzzler. I'm lower down on the food chain than Officer Cat Fancy.
No.
Jess calls for a team switch so that she can now question Winston. He tries to lie that it's he who Cece likes, but neither of them can keep a straight face. This just leaves Nick as the only remaining possible crush object. This next part of the conversation I've included for blatant pandering reasons. Please play clip five.
Oh my God, my ex-boyfriend and my best friend? Ugh, I feel like Brenda when Kelly dated Dylan. Or the other way around.
No, I know those are the characters from the original 90210, but that's about my ceiling. Dylan, was his nickname the Peach Pit? Because I remember remember that being a whole thing.
I'm sorry, I'm a little wound up.
You should be wound up because the Peach Pit used to be yours. But now Brenda wants a slice. Everybody trying to get a slice of that Peach Pit.
Winston's last attempt to quash the topic goes rather awry, leading to Jess calling for new teams so that she can confront Nick, resulting in clip six.
I'm just going to break in here because Helen forgot to say, Nick thinks Jess is talking about Cece's desire to get a popcorn machine for the bar, which he is sick of hearing about. Jess is talking about Cece and Nick dating, hence the misunderstanding, which we will hear in this clip.
Is that what this is about? She sends you to sell me on it?
No, Nick, she doesn't know I'm talking to at all. Wait, you guys have talked about it?
All the time. But I thought she and I had come to a decision.
Which is...
It's not happening.
Well, why not?
Because I'm not interested. And I know it's not cool to say, but I don't like the way it would look.
People are going to say what they're going to say. They're not reasons not to go through with it.
Fine. You want to know my biggest concern? My biggest concern is the smell.
The smell?
The smell of it. Yeah, and it's not Cece's fault. I mean, they all smell. I've told her that.
You told Cece... You think all women...
Don't make this a feminist thing.
I'm not making it a feminist thing.
How? They smell terrible. It's common knowledge.
I thought your biggest concern
would be how it affected the people around you.
I mean, sure, a bunch of old drunks will grab
But if your biggest
it,
concern
but...
is the smell, I'm sure that's highly manageable.
Yeah, I guess there's like special solvents and soaps. I haven't read up on it that much. You know, but you gotta really get in there and scrub it out. It's disgusting. You know, because of the daily wear and tear and oil and grease just cooking in there. It's enough to make a man barf thinking about it. I mean, they get really hot.
I know what temperature it gets.
But if I'm being honest, you know, and I haven't talked to her about this, but I do have good memories associated with the smell. Ball games, the circus, hanging with my dad.
Listen here, you idiot. I've known Cece a very long time, and I can promise you the smell will not be a problem.
It's really easy for you to say, because you're not the one who's going to have to remind her to clean it all the time.
I promise you, if it becomes a problem, I will remind her.
Well, if you remind her and she doesn't do it, I don't want you sneaking around and cleaning it yourself.
Nick, I'm a good friend, but I am not that good of a friend.
I know the old misunderstanding, talking across purposes conversation is a bit of a sitcom cliche, but I think this is one of the better takes on this. And Zooey Deschanel's delivery of, I know what temperature it gets, is perfect. From here, things resolve quickly. Jess realizes her mistake and Cece comes clean to her. In the C plot, Coach accidentally sends all his draft emails to the girl he likes, but she's charmed by him, setting up Damon Wayne Jr.'s coming departure from the show. The spider is spotted on Schmidt's face. Vaughn arrives and coolly dispatches the spider. There's a meal, a toast of friendship, and that's the end. But over the end credits, we do get to see a little more of 10-foot Ralph Macchio. I love this episode because it's just such a fun time. At this point in the show, the characters are all developed and have a history that we understand. Winston, so underserved by the first few episodes of the series, has come into his own, as the number of clips featuring him show. Jess is an actual character rather than a bundle of quirks. Her history with Nick complicates the situation, but there's no over-the-top jealousy over her friend's presumed crush. She loves them both. And Schmidt is somehow still a mess of braggadocio and insecurity, and as Cece says, perfect. And Nick is occasionally really good at one thing. The characters are all delightful friends, but more than that, this episode is just funny. I hope you've enjoyed Spider Hunt and that it will find its way into the canon.
Thank you, Helen. Nadia, you chose this from our list of submissions. Please start us off. What did you think of the argument and the episode?
I agree with both. I always forget how much New Girl is one of those shows that, like, I have a lot of shows that I rewatch over and over again, probably to the annoyance of my husband. I'm just on my billionth rewatch of Mad Men right now. But New Girl is just so, once it gets into its groove, it's just a wonderful depiction of friendships. And, like, the note that I took to myself about this one episode was that, like, you get to see each character gets paired off with a different character in their apartment in the loft. And you just get to see exactly how they play off of each other, how much they love each other, mm-hmm. how much they misunderstand each other, how much they, their little quirks and their little like synchronicities. And it's just this beautiful, like Nick is in the middle of the kitchen throwing sprinkles and meats and mayonnaise into this disgusting sauce that is somehow delicious. And Jess is trying to like, I mean, she's obviously dealing with some sort of hurt of thinking about Nick being with her best friend, but still, it's what Helen said, that she's trying to make, she'll make it happen no matter what, even if it hurts her. And Cece's just trying to be cool while trying to get, keep things from Jess, who's like, she knows Jess is her number one savior, and I could go on and on. It's just, I don't know, it's that perfect encapsulation of exactly who these people are in their lives and in their lives together. And where they're going to go, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if this was a party and you were like went there as a friend of the friend, you didn't know the other five of them, you would get a sense of the dynamics of that group pretty quickly. And I think mm-hmm. that speaks to the writing in the episode. Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't be awkward either. I feel mm-hmm. like they would welcome you in and just but still be who they are. And it's not putting on a show for us.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, why don't you go next?
This show, you sort of don't realize it until you get to the end of the episode. But I haven't watched a lot of the show. Every time I do, I'm like, maybe I should get into it. Maybe you should go on the list. When I'll get to it, who knows, 2034, whatever. But in retrospect, you look back and you realize that like it is pretty careful this episode about making sure that you understand what the stakes are and how everybody does relate to each other.
Yep.
And then after like 4 minutes of that, which is still like funny and well-paced, then the joke density like increases by like a power of 10. And there are so many quotes just from the spider hunt section of this, like Schmidt's delivery of hanging from its butt rope. I mean, like as a non-arachnophile, I have come to accept that they eat worse bugs, and like there's one no further than 8 feet from you at any given time, whatever, it's fine. But his horror is so relatable, and like the number of wrong things that he comes up with to say about them, like half insects, half lobsters, made me laugh for like 20 yeah. minutes. Obviously hanging from its butt rope. 10-foot-tall Ralph Macchio is just like, why? And then it just keeps going on, and it's like kind of a good costume, but not great, which is yeah. perfect. Like, this is just packed. This is like a happy endings peak, happy yeah. endings level of joke density. And maybe mm-hmm. I only think that because Coach was also on, Damon Wayans was also on that show. But mm-hmm. I mean, and his delivery, I like her much. And that whole, like the bits with the email, like the balance among all the different axes of plot and misunderstanding are perfect. Mm-hmm. I totally agree with Helen that like this sort of idiot plot misunderstanding conversation is a sitcom trope, mm-hmm. but it's a trope for a reason. And when it's done well, it's really a pleasure to watch people like doing it well, to watch
yes.
good writing and good performances of it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's just so many little throwaway lines that, like, I basically want to get tattoos of. Like, a murder of peppercorn, perfect. Do ladies have loins just, like, as he's going out of the room? Like, this show is so assured that it is at its own peak, but it's not, like, annoying about it the way some shows can be. And yeah. Lauren Bishop as Winston, undersung performance, that like word cliche salad at the beginning is glorious, and I'm so glad it was clipped. That there's something called the dandelion incident. I mean, that note about going to a party at the loft, even if you were a friend of a friend, and immediately feeling comfortable sort of parallels what I'm saying about the structure of this episode, mm-hmm. that even if you're not really familiar with the show, the episode's writing is like, okay, here's what we're doing, and then yep. just drops it into overdrive, and it's so good. It was just a delightful 22 minutes, and great presentation. Thank you, Helen, and Smushers and Jarman. Like, yes, yes, I felt seen, and I felt happy. I laughed many times.
Steinbeck's lost work.
Dave, you go next, and I'll close
all right. I had bailed on New Girl by the time this episode aired, I believe. So this was new to me. And oh my fucking God, I laughed so much at the whole popcorn personal hygiene chunk. I was in tears. It was so funny. Like, yeah, it is a trope. And it is like so much of 70s sitcoms yes. in totality is based on
it's like
that.
Like every Three's episode Company. Of Three's Company. Yes,
exactly.
Totally.
Like, so I was like, that was the mode of sitcoms when I was growing up. So I am well versed in it, and it has lessened, thankfully. But man, when you see it done right, it's so dumb and funny.
Yeah.
And dumb yeah. and funny, nobody's really mentioned it. It was just in passing in the argument. But Nick Sauce.
He makes, oh my God.
Bologna, mayo, sprinkles, peppercorn.
He makes sauce like I make vegetarian chili.
Yeah.
Oh.
What's in the fridge
yeah.
is going to go in your mouth eventually. Here we go.
And
it's time for chili.
And they left the farty noise of the condiments. Like, and he's just like, yeah.
And just like the weird, uh-huh. like too smooth and a little too orange photo or shot of it that they have. Is just, yeah. I don't know, it was perfect. I really enjoyed just like every once in a while, you get a little bit more of the sauce story, and it is as confounding at stage one as it is at stage 10 at the end yep. of it. And then the kicker is Fawn describes it as, it tastes like the inside of a bear, and I mean that as a compliment. Mm-hmm. Great. Payoff.
Yep. Bringing it all around, too,
that's
to
right.
the bear.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
she's right. It's just like fun, stupid, good time. It doesn't need to be really much more of that. It just is firing on all cylinders from start to finish. And it made me laugh the hardest I've laughed in a while on things we've been watching here. So well done, Helen.
Yep. The thing about the 10-foot-tall Ralph Macchio is that you don't need to see it for mm-hmm. that joke to work. But then you do, no. and it just adds to it.
Do you think somebody who is empowered to make that happen in the prop department wanted that for a Halloween yeah. costume, and they wrote it in so that it would exist and they could take it for Halloween?
I got a real Ray Donchong challenge vibe from that, mm-hmm. that it was like, let's mm-hmm. get this, like, let's force them to not only work it into the script, but to execute the visual.
Yes. I don't have a ton to add. I was still watching the show at this point, but I have not rewatched New Girl, partly because I have pitched it as a rewatchable show to Dave, and he has said no. Perhaps this will change his mind.
Okay, well, let me just say, this is not super... I feel like the biggest mistake they made with New Girl was letting the marketing department go ham on
yeah.
Adorkable.
Adorkable, yes. yeah.
Because I feel like it colored everything like that mm-hmm. they did after that, and maybe they sure. played into it, the
it's
writing.
Fair.
Yeah.
But also, it's so good.
I wonder, like, I watched a few seasons of it.
Yeah.
I just got bored with it, I think, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if the creator has come out on that piece of marketing and whether she was involved with that. Because usually there's, like, you have no say in that part mm-hmm. of it. It just happens. Right. And I kind of feel like, that is not something she would bring to the table.
Perhaps not. But we have liked other works of hers. I made you watch Bless This Mess.
Yeah, Bless This Mess was fine too.
Yep. And we like that too. Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons that Dave enjoyed this episode so much is because it is Jess light. This is in the post Jess and Nick phase. Dave is not a romance person in terms of his sitcoms. And I think the better episodes are ones that are not about Jess's love life. Personally, although I have enjoyed episodes that are like that too, and there is one in the canon, this is not an episode that's about them. And and I think it's funnier for that, that Jess can be annoying, and having her as a supporting player in this story plays more to her strengths as a character on the show, in my opinion. I realize that's crazy to say because she is the new girl, but
yeah.
even so, I mean, I honestly, everything else that we would say about this is kind of secondary to just like the misunderstanding scene conversation, which is like, that is the nut graph of this episode, and it's like it's canon worthy in and of itself. It's so funny, so perfectly written and performed, every single aspect of it. The fact that he is still stirring the fucking sauce the entire time, as someone who has to be on stir patrol every time that chili is made, yep. and it is very serious, yep. I understand the process is important.
I'm stirring it.
Yes.
You want char at the bottom of your chili
no,
pot?
No, I don't.
Don't stir.
Yes, I just stirred
and let me
it.
Just tell you,
don't let the sauce stick.
If you're like, Dave, buy one of those automatic stirrer machines. It doesn't work with chili. It's too thick. My chili is too thick for those. That's it just right. stops, and then you come back half an hour later, and the bottom's burned. So okay. fuck you, stirmate.com.
Anyway. This is my fault because I brought it up. This was a great episode that I like did not even remember, because New Girl, I think, is a pretty consistently great show. But I was very happy to revisit it. And I think Helen beautifully elucidated all the reasons that make this a very enjoyable and special episode in its complete banality. And I mean that as a compliment. Like, yep. This is just how good this show is, even in an episode you might not necessarily specifically remember.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's put this to the official vote. Nadia, canon worthy or not?
Yes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I have one last note, and that's the spider shriek that is the outro to an ad break and then resumes unbroken after the ad break. Uh-huh. Yes, been there, been that shrieker. And yes, canon worthy.
Tara?
Yes.
All right, 4-4-4, I vote yes too, so... That means New Girl, Season 4, Episode 17, Spider Hunt, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time to discover the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I sure do. It's Documentary Now, which has booked Alexander Skarsgård to play a Werner Herzog type in a season 4 episode. And secondarily, I believe that tangential to the story today, Miss Tara Ariano finally figured out how we should spell and punctuate the word focus. So if anyone's interested, hit us up on the Discord. We would love to share Tara's fine work with you all.
And Tara, who is our loser of the week?
Well, first of all, me, because I have to correct myself from last week. I said Ryan Grantham was on the Canadian Riverdale that was from many years before the Archie-affiliated one on the CW. He was not even born yet, so thank you to Daniel McKecker and past and future guests for letting me know. No, he was
Canadian
on...
Canadian TV cop. Woo, woo, woo!
Exactly. Yeah. He was on the CW's Riverdale, and the reason I should have known that, even though he was Canadian, rather than assume that he was on a Canadian show, is that, like all of the CW shows, Riverdale shoots in Vancouver, so of course that's the one he was on. So anyway, sorry to this murderer. For this week's loser, speaking of Canadians who suck, Firefly star Nathan Fillion, who was recently asked whether he would work with Joss Whedon again after, you know, everything, and he said he would in a second. So cool dude alert, Nathan Fillion.
All right, speaking about cool dudes, do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
It is.
Game time.
In fact, game time. All right, everybody, welcome back to Game Time. We're still early in the season. Our scores are Tara with 1, Sarah and Value Guest still looking to get on the board. Today we're playing Is It the Thing? CSI Edition from Erica, who earns herself an extra credit topic of her choosing. In this edition of Is This a Thing? Was this person a guest star in the CSI franchise? You'll hear a description of the guest star in question, as well as what series we're talking about. You say, were they, in fact, a guest star, or they were not? All right, let's throw it to Picky to see who... Let's throw it a picky to see who will be confirmed. Oh my God.
Wow.
I just had 4 strokes.
Are you okay?
Guys.
Do you have vapor lock?
I just had 4 strokes right in a row. Let's throw it a picky to see who will be going first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right. We'll start with Nadia and then we'll move on to Sarah and then Tara. Are we ready? I know I am to play Is This a Thing? CSI Edition.
Yes.
Yes.
All right, here we go. Nadia, I will give you the show and the scenario. You tell me whether it happened or not. CSI Las Vegas, original Rays, original CSI. Justin Bieber as a serial bomber who goes down in a hail of bullets. Did that happen or did it not happen?
No.
It did happen. That it is did. True.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
Yep.
How did I not? I've never really watched CSI. I will say that. So really sad that I missed that.
You missed a little something. But for most of this game, I think you're probably okay. Not Sarah, CSI New York is your first question. Michael Clark Duncan as a man falsely imprisoned for killing a guy with a hammer. Happened? Yes or no?
I mean, in the Green Mile, yes. So I'm going to say no.
It did happen.
Oh, boy.
My goodness. All right, Tara, see if you can get the first correct question of the game. Mm-hmm. CSI Cyber.
Yeah.
Zach Braff has a hacker who kills his former high school bully.
I feel like I'm supposed to say yes, but I think he was too big to do this, so I'm going to say no.
You are correct. That did not happen. Back to Nadia. Mm-hmm. CSI Miami. Channing Tatum as a wannabe rapper suspected of murder. Was that guest star appearance real? She says yes, and she is correct.
Hey.
It seems like something C. Tates would do.
Yeah.
Sarah D. Bunting, CSI original, Las Vegas. Taylor Swift as a murder victim in her first ever acting appearance.
Pretty sure that happened, yes.
You are correct. Tara.
Yep.
Miami. Chris Pine as a man who dies of erotic asphyxiation.
Ooh, he was right on the line of fame at that time. Boy, that's a tough one. But and I'm still going to say no.
You can watch that. It's real.
Wow.
Back to Nadia. CSI New York. Gwen Stefani as a patient with dissociative identity disorder who stabs one of the New York CSIs.
I'm going to say yes. Womp.
Did not happen. Sarah D. Bunting, Miami. Heather Locklear, Melrose Place's own Heather Locklear, as a madam who gets shoved down an elevator shaft.
I feel like I would have heard of this before, but I also feel like that's too detailed to not have happened. So I will say yes, that occurred.
Erica, gotcha. Did not happen.
Well done, Erica.
Tara, CSI New York.
Yep.
Shailene Woodley as an actor who gets accidentally beheaded during a reenactment of Marie Antoinette's execution.
I'm going to say yes, because that should be true.
And it is. Back to Nadia.
Yep, for not calling yourself a feminist.
CSI Original, Las Vegas. Jackson Galaxy as himself, who undiscovers that a murder victim actually fell down the stairs after tripping over a cat.
Yes.
No, did not happen.
Wow.
Feels like it should have, though.
The cat was a good detail.
Sarah D. Bunting, Miami. Dean Winters as David Caruso's brother, who gets beaten to death by members of a crime syndicate. Did that casting actually happen, or did Erica cast those as brothers? Yes or no?
I think that actually happened.
It did. Tara, CSI Original, Las Vegas. Huh? David Copperfield as an amateur magician who actually saws his assistant in half.
No.
Nadia, CSI Original, Las Vegas. Roger Daltrey as a master of disguise.
No.
Yes, you can watch that.
We did. It was a bad one.
It was really bad. He has like 4 or 5 costume changes in the whole thing. And they're all so like, how big can my nose be?
Yeah. Wad makeup.
A lot of putty. Sarah D. Bunting, New York. Ashley Simpson as a hotel maid who gets caught up in a smuggling ring in which cocaine is hidden inside corpses. True? Did that happen? False, it did not happen. Yes or no?
I feel like Erica knows better than to toy with Ashley Simpson under false pretenses, so I'm going to say yes.
Yes.
Hey!
All right, this will take us into our score break. It is for Tara. It is CSI Las Vegas.
Okay.
Reginald Vell Johnson and James Avery as brothers who are hunted by a hitman for being card counters.
Oh, my God. No.
Correct. That did not happen.
But I wish.
And that will bring us into our first score break. Let's hear them score, Star.
Boy, it's really close. This game is surprisingly challenging. Nadia is on the board with 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting and I are tied with 3 each.
All right.
Dun, dun, dun.
We are back into it for Nadia. CSI Miami is your show. Mm-hmm. Pitbull as a used car salesman who turns out to be the most prolific serial killer in Florida history.
Yes. Damn it. That would be so good, though.
Yeah, it really would.
Yeah, the problem with this game is that sometimes you answer with what you want.
Yeah.
That it should exist.
But when you start with that Justin Bieber one, it's like, well, anything is possible, exactly. I guess. Like, this is what's diabolical about this game.
This is question 17 for Sarah.
Spread Eagle.
The Spread Eagle.
CSI New York. John McEnroe as himself and someone who looks exactly like him.
Yeah, that seems like something that happened.
Indeed it did.
Hey!
Tara.
Yep.
Vegas. Mm-hmm. CSI Las Vegas Original. I don't think we have any Vegas.
Oh, of the revival? Yeah. Okay.
Anytime I say Vegas, it's the old one.
The original. Yeah. Got it.
Katie Sagal as a murder victim and as someone also dead who looks exactly like her.
I'm going to say no.
Yes.
They did it twice? Oh, they're so lazy.
Double dipping. CSI Miami for Nadia. Daniel Stern as a party clown accused of murdering someone who looks exactly like him.
Oh, God, is it going to be three in a row?
Erica's, you know, in all your minds.
Yeah, let's just do it. Yes. God damn it.
That was question 19.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting, Vegas, comma, loss. Faye Dunaway as the socialite author of a tell-all book about Vegas who murders a man at her birthday party.
A book about who murders a man at her birthday party. I feel like I can picture most of these, which is a problem because many of them did not occur. Yeah. I think this one happened, though, so I'll say yes.
You're correct. Yes, it did happen. Tara, New York.
Yep.
Dean Koontz as a struggling author suspected of murdering his rival, Stevie Queen.
No.
You are correct. That did not happen. Nadia, original Las Vegas. Doug Jones as a mime who gets killed with a lawnmower.
No.
You are correct, but damn it. Sarah D. Bunting, also Vegas. Aisha Tyler as a DNA technician who gets hit on by most of the male lab techs.
I'm pretty sure I actually do remember that, so I'll say yes.
Yeah, I feel like that was like all the episodes that she was in. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tara.
Yes, Dave.
Miami. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Berkeley as a woman who mothered a child with David Caruso.
I think this is real.
This is indeed real, yes. Nadia, CSI New York. Skeet Ulrich as the Compass Killer, who kills during the phenomena known as Manhattanhenge.
I want this to be real, so I'm going to say yes.
You have been rewarded.
Whoa!
Sarah D. Bunting, also New York. Chris Angel as illusionist Luke Blade, who attempts to drown his abusive stepmother. Wow, that's a lot there. Chris Angel as an illusionist named Luke Blade, who attempts to drown his abusive stepmother.
I mean, that's good detail, but Erica gets in her heads with that. So I also feel like Chris Angel is not a New York guy. So I'm going to say no. That fucker.
Tara, also New York.
Yeah.
Ed Asner, we miss him, as former Nazi guard hiding in the guise of a Jewish jeweler. Yep, that's okay. A real one.
Wow, nice.
Back to Nadia and back to original Ray's CSI. Jeffrey Tambor, we miss him. No. As an artist who paints portrait of people who look dead.
No?
Yes.
Damn it.
That is real.
Wow.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting, Miami. Michael Dorn as a podiatrist who someone frames for murder by putting feet into his freezer.
We've all been there.
So, Worf.
Yeah, Worf, yeah.
As a podiatrist. No.
Yeah, nice. You're correct, but damn. All right, Tara.
Yep.
New York. Mm. Edward Furlong as the serial killer who becomes arch nemesis for one of the CSIs.
Oh, God. Fuck.
Walk us through your thought process.
Credits to Erica. He's the perfect level of famous to possibly have a recurring arc, but also possibly not. I'm going to say no.
That happened. Shit. Indeed. All right. Everybody's last question coming at you. So let's get to the first place.
Well, Nadia has 3. Mm-hmm. I have 6. Sarah D. Bunting. 7.
All right. So,
what will happen?
We could force a tie up top. Let us figure it all out with Nadia's last question. Also, Vegas. Will Wheaton as a homeless man who thinks he's in trouble for stealing a sweater.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Nice.
Sarah D. Bunting, New York. B. Arthur as a retired police commissioner who hates Gary Sinise's guts.
No.
Correct.
Yes! Sarah I was going to say, they wish, and then I was like, oh, I can't.
And closing us, I believe at the top I said 32 questions. Obviously, it needs to be 33, and this is the 33rd. Tara.
Yep.
Las Vegas. Mm. Lev Schreiber as a CSI who commits murder out of revenge, only to find out he's killed the wrong man.
This one's real.
Yeah, we watched that recently. It is. Final scores, please, Tara.
Nadia finished strong with 4. I had 7. Sarah DeBunting is our victor with 8.
All right.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Congratulations. And congratulations to Erica for so many fools. Fuck. Got it good. All right, Sarah.
She should pitch them, I think.
Yep. Same.
Sarah.
All right, guys. That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Grade. We sat down family style for the Chicago beef drama, The Bear, before going around the dial with stops at Loot, Miss Marvel, and the Janes. What's got 20 legs and is in the cannon thanks to Helen? New Girl Spider Hunt. Pause for clap. All right. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Sarah was a winner of this week's Game Time from Erica. Next up, Twilight Zone Purple Balls on Extra, Extra Hot Grade. And on the next, EHG Prime's Holiday Force Innings Frogging. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara.
Looks like she ratted herself out.
Aw, Sarah.
New teams.
And Nadia.
Who loves celebrating both Eids, both greater and lesser.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Don't go up the spout if you can't handle the rain, spider.
Okay, well, you've done it. The perfect burn of a dead bug.
Yeah, that's right.
Now stop.